Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. As we mentioned earlier in the hour, arthritis most likely will become a fact of life for almost all of us, and even some youth suffer from the aches and pains of the disease. Joining us to discuss are Dr. Mike Smith. He's a rheumatologist in Kansas City. Good morning, Mike. Thanks so much for being here.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
And we also have Dr. Carol Lindsley. She's a pediatric rheumatologist at the University of Kansas Hospital. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Dr. Smith, how do you even begin to diagnose arthritis? What exactly is it?
Well, arthritis, there's many different types of arthritis. But in general, arthritis starts with just pain in the joints. And that's generally when patients come to see us is when they start to have pain in the joints. Now, that can take a lot of – people can have a lot of different symptoms with that. Swelling in the joints, pain, stiffness, all of those things factor into the diagnosis. And like I said, there's multiple different types of arthritis. I think that in certain literature that there's over 100 different types when you get really specific with it. So, you know, there's a lot of different things that go into which type of arthritis we have and how to come about that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. So is this is it mostly a symptom diagnosis, people coming in complaining of symptoms, or are there actual like procedures or tests you can do, measurements you can take with MRIs or x-rays? Is there like some also signs to it?
Sure. Well, like I said, it starts with symptoms, and that's how they end up getting to a rheumatologist in many cases. But there are exam findings as well. There are certain tests you can do. X-rays are obviously very important to determine the degree of arthritis. However, in many cases, it's also both history and the physical exam in addition to some of these other tests. MRI can be useful later on, but usually a plain x-ray is sufficient, at least initially.
That surprised me a little. I thought x-rays, you know, work better on bone, but so you're essentially measuring like how close the bones are to each other. You don't necessarily even need to see the soft tissue that you would like in an MRI. Is that what you're saying?
Like I said, it depends. So there's mm-hmm. certain types of arthritis and different levels of different types of arthritis warrant different types mm-hmm. of tests. An MRI isn't always needed. But it does look at more of the soft tissue in there. But for things like osteoarthritis and even for rheumatoid arthritis, two of the more, you know, common and at least well-known types of arthritis, x-rays are generally sufficient. When there's more things to look at, obviously, you know, more expensive and more involved tests like MRI are possible. But like you were saying, with an x-ray, with osteoarthritis in particular, you're looking for, you know, how closely the joints have come together, some deterioration of that soft tissue in between there. And with rheumatoid arthritis, you're looking for the erosive and damaging type of arthritis where it can cause erosions on each side of the joint.
Like into the bone itself.
Correct.
I didn't know that. We'll come back to that. Dr. Lindsley, you work with juvenile arthritis, which is something a little different and was entirely news to me. I didn't know that children could suffer from it. Can you explain a little bit about the patients that come into your practice?
You're not unusual in that you haven't heard about it because although it affects maybe a quarter of them, quarter of a million children, 250,000 children in the country, it's much less common than adult arthritis, so people just associate arthritis with adults. But in fact, there are a significant number of kids nationwide that have arthritis. Their presentation, their complaints, the findings are different for the most part than in adults, although if you look very carefully at the what's going on in the joint itself, in the synovial lining of the joint, which is the site of inflammation.
Synovial lining.
Right.
A little technical term. Can you help?
That's just the lining layer mm-hmm. of the joints, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's where the inflammation is in children and in adult rheumatoid arthritis. So that is similar between the two diseases. But other than that, there are a lot of differences. X-rays and imaging are much less helpful early on, and the laboratory tests are many times negative in children. So I frequently see children that have stiffness or soreness or limping, and people have run X-rays and lab tests on them, and then parents have been told, well, all the tests for arthritis are negative. So the heart of the diagnosis in children is what you see on physical exam.
So when you have these kids who probably are also going through growing pains. Do they get like misdiagnosed or easily dismissed? I think sometimes we dismiss children's pain also as, you know, being less severe than adult pain.
That's true. And it does get confused with groin pains, but actually they're very different. Groin pains are really muscle spasms, so it's not in the joints per se. So anytime a child has a swollen joint or is limping or has persistent complaints, that is a concern and they need to be evaluated.
And you, Dr. Smith, you mentioned earlier there are essentially the big umbrellas for arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis. Can you explain a little bit about rheumatoid and osteoarthritis, and the differences between them? And then Dr. Lindsley, if you could like kind of piggyback on that, because it seems to me like it might be related a little bit, at least tangentially, to rheumatoid arthritis, juvenile arthritis.
They are. I'll explain.
Dr. Smith. Sure. So, it gets into this definition of inflammatory arthritis versus non-inflammatory arthritis. And osteoarthritis is something that, you know, probably for everyone will experience some form of that or at least have some form of that, whether it's symptomatic or not. I think it's somewhat inevitable for everyone at some point in their lives, if they live long enough, obviously. Rheumatoid arthritis is what we define as an inflammatory arthritis, where there's significant swelling, warmth, coupled with pain and lots of stiffness, typically beyond 30 minutes is the definition in many cases.
So by stiffness, you mean like it's hard to actually like move your joints, like your hands or your knees, like it just the physical act of doing that is difficult.
In terms of the stiffness, you're talking about when you get up in the morning, when you're sitting for long periods of time and then getting up, which is what we call gelling. So you're kind of looking at those two types of things. You know, oftentimes in the morning when people are getting up and they have rheumatoid arthritis, you know, they'll come to us, especially the first time, and have upwards of, 30 to an hour. Sometimes they say it's all morning, and it just varies where they are in the whole line of this process. Also they can have similar type symptoms after they've been sitting for long periods of time. But like I said, it also involves a little bit of like what Dr. Lindsley was saying with the synovial lining. Both of them locally at the synovial lining do have an element of inflammation. Rheumatoid arthritis is just a systemic inflammatory process where it's not just in the joints. There's lots of other things that can be evolved in rheumatoid arthritis over time. And kids actually seem to manifest that sometimes more so than adults. But there are, more systemic manifestations of the inflammatory types of arthritis than with osteoarthritis, which seems to be just in the joints.
Is rheumatoid arthritis a little bit more related to an autoimmune kind of disease?
It absolutely is an autoimmune disease. And, our immune system is very much involved in, structuring and at least forming inflammation to fight off these things. And that's how we fight off things like infections and even cancer cells in many cases is our immune system recognizing those and using the inflammation to fight those off. I always explain it to patients is, your immune system works just fine. It just seems to have taken a wrong turn and hasn't stopped. It works just fine to fight off infection. It just seems to have done a little bit more than it should have and has then led to this.
And so it's attacking the joints of your body, essentially.
In a roundabout way, yeah. To an extent, the immune system is mediating this, but there's a lot of technical stuff that goes into it. Like you said, a lot of medical jargon and a lot of other things that go into it. But in essence, yes, it's an autoimmune disease process that does affect the joints, but it causes systemic inflammation.
Dr. Lindsley, how does juvenile arthritis compare to rheumatoid arthritis, which we might be more familiar with
The most common form of chronic arthritis in children is called juvenile idiopathic arthritis, all right? And there are seven different subtypes underneath that. So JIA is a sort of an umbrella term. One of those subsets is similar to adult rheumatoid arthritis.
As like an autoimmune
disease. That's right. There may be autoimmune factors in all of the subtypes, but as far as clinically and detecting autoantibodies, there's one type called seropositive polyarticular disease.
That's a mouthful. Try to say that.
I know. That is very similar to adult rheumatoid arthritis. Mm-hmm. But the rest of them are fairly different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when the kids come in, like, how do you begin to make that distinction about, which one they have? I understand it's kind of hard to make a diagnosis, as you were saying, for juvenile arthritis just in general. So
yeah.
how do you begin
we
to –
We rely on – some of the things Dr. Smith mentioned, the history, all right? The kids are stiff and sore in the morning, even though they may not complain. They may be limping or have other trouble moving around. And then on the physical exam, that's key. We need to look for swelling and limitation of motion and put that together with we use x-rays to some extent, but not nearly as they're not nearly as helpful as they are in adults because the kids are resilient as far as changing their structures that the x-rays will show. And the lab tests are frequently negative, except for the one group I mentioned that is positive. So mm-hmm. we're just trying to put all – it's like putting a puzzle together, okay? Mm-hmm.
So it can take time to kind of come to a real firm diagnosis and then begin appropriate treatment, a little bit of trial and error.
And many times we – if we have a fairly firm diagnosis, we go ahead and start treatment most of the time and go ahead and work out all of the other details as we see how the disease progresses.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. We're streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and our guests are Dr. Mike Smith. He's a rheumatologist in Kansas City here, and Dr. Carol Lindsley. She's a pediatric rheumatologist at the University of Kansas Hospital. We're discussing arthritis, the pains, and we'll begin to the treatments later in the hour and hopes for future advancements. Kansas City, do you or your child have arthritis? How has it impacted your life? What treatments have worked for you and what has fallen short? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us. Our address is centralstandard@kcur.org. Dr. Smith, what are some of the contributing risk factors to getting either rheumatoid arthritis or osteoarthritis?
Well, you know, with osteoarthritis, first off, the main contributing factor is age. Mm-hmm. As we age, we, you know, have more wear and tear in our joints. Now, that isn't always, you know, factor for every single person. There's genetics that go into that. There's also environment. You know, some people may be more predisposed to more severe forms of osteoarthritis than others. You know, you can see that sometimes as an example, I'll see folks and they have kind of knobby looking fingers right at the end and they've had these nodules. That oftentimes is genetic and people can have more knee and hip osteoarthritis with those forms. And sometimes those can be more severe than others. One of the other predisposing factors are traumatic events in our life. So, you know, oftentimes I'll have folks come in and they may be younger in life, you know, in their 40s and 50s and even early 60s when you wouldn't expect them to have quite as much severe arthritis, but they report history of, you know, severe car accidents or, you know, they played sports or, you know, they had multiple sports injuries or any of all those things. You know, traumatic injuries to those things can predispose that and kind of set the clock ahead earlier.
Do those injuries include things like ACL, MCL tears? Does that have to be like truly traumatic in the sense like – warranting, you know, surgery? Or can it be like, I played, you know, tons and tons of football, never had a bad injury, but, you know, here I am?
Yeah, you know, it can be as simple as soft tissue injuries to that because it does impact the joint. And that's really what arthritis is about is the inflammation, even locally with osteoarthritis, you know, on the joint and those factors that predispose from that standpoint. You know, from a personal standpoint, playing football, I had, you know, blown out a bursa in my knee and it pops and cracks when I go up and down the stairs now. And so, you know, I know that that'll just be a fact of life from here on out. And that's what I tell folks. But even, you know, surgeries that are very helpful, you know, 5 to 10 years down the line, you know, they do involve getting into the joint. And I'm not saying not to do those, but they can, you know, any kind of surgeries, any kind of trauma to the joint, which, you know, while very helpful initially, can sometimes lead to more of that later in life. And I think people who have had those can attest to that as well.
You mentioned the popping of the joints. If I do have, you know, a shoulder that, you know, I keep having to click in or something like that, is that a sign that I should be, like, you know, mindful, you know, 10, 20 years down the line, I should be, you know, like, just keeping an eye on this? Like, you're mentioning something that sounds like just the process of being human, you know, like, my knee just isn't 100%. My shoulder isn't just 100%. Like, when should I be concerned or be thinking about, you know, visiting a rheumatologist?
I think if it becomes, you know, more of a limitation in life, especially if it's not swollen, you know, or warm or anything like that, I think if it starts to become a limitation, then that's probably the case. You know, we all will have aches and pains, mm-hmm. you know, in life, and it doesn't always necessarily mean that you're developing severe arthritis. But, you know, if it becomes a limiting factor or seems to be more regular and more painful.
And Dr. Lindsley, contributing risk factors for juvenile arthritis, what should parents, you know, perhaps heighten their sensitivity to considering it as a possibility?
We certainly don't know all the risk factors yet, and some that Dr. Smith mentioned, you know, the family, if there are certain markers in certain types of arthritis. I don't know if you want me to get into those, mm-hmm. but there are mm-hmm. certain genetic markers that apply to some of the types of childhood arthritis and are helpful in making the diagnosis, mm-hmm. but certainly nowhere near all of them, all right? And that is certain, so certain genetic markers are risk factors, and that's really all we know. We feel that it's an interaction between the environment and your genetic makeup. Mm-hmm. Something triggers it.
Dr. Smith.
And one of the things you asked about between osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis, the one thing I wanted to throw in terms of rheumatoid arthritis is a huge risk factor for rheumatoid arthritis is smoking.
Mm.
And so, you know, I think that rheumatologists have known that for longer, but that has come out even more so in recent literature.
Oh, why is that? I mean, the connection to the carcinogens in the smoke makes sense for your lungs, even to your heart. That makes sense to me. But when does the smoke touch our joints?
You know, it's more of its effect on the immune system and how it works from that standpoint. There's one particular antibody that we check, the anti-CCP antibody, which is a specific antibody for rheumatoid arthritis. And those with rheumatoid arthritis are familiar with that antibody. But
And that antibody is a good thing in some situations, but too much of it causes rheumatoid arthritis.
Well, part of the C is citrullinated. And so we do citrullinate certain proteins as part of the immune system and part of our normal processes. But when that goes abnormal, which is, you know, what I think has been postulated and seen somewhat in laboratory settings, that the carcinogens and different elements of cigarette smoke have caused some of that and may predispose to doing that more often. You know, the antibodies, I think, we're not completely sure that they're causative in many of these cases, but we do know that they're very much associated with the arthritis. And cigarette smoking obviously impacts that, so we do know that part of it. And so I've seen that it's a huge risk factor. And even when people do have rheumatoid arthritis, makes it, in some cases, more difficult to treat. They don't respond to medications as well. So that's why I want to make sure I put that out there. So,
Well, we have a call here from Dan. Dan and Lawrence, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much.
Morning, and what's your question or comment for us this morning?
Well, I have a couple of questions. One is I teach a physiology course at a local community college, and the textbook that I'm currently using, and that's always a risk because of the dating of them, but it suggests that there may be some benefit in the treatment of arthritic patients with supplements including chondroitin sulfate, glucosamine, And strangely enough, I have two dogs that I've had surgeries on for a knee rebuilding that was done. And in the cases of both the animals, one's younger and one's older, the vet suggested that I put them on a healthy maintenance diet that has glucosamine, chondroitin, and also something carnitine. Well, I'm trying to teach students, many of whom are going to go into health professions, mm-hmm. what seems to be an evidence-based approach. And the evidence that I've looked into seems to indicate there's very little support from clinical trials in using any of these in humans, at the very least. And I've wondered what your experience has been in recommending those or not recommending them. For what it's worth, with the two dogs, it seems to have made a remarkable difference.
Well, very interesting experience you have there, Dan. Let's give them an opportunity to reply. Also, you had a number of really technical terms there that I wasn't too familiar with. Are you folks familiar with some of the treatments he was suggesting?
The glucosamine and chondroitin are medications that people have tried, or supplements that people have tried for osteoarthritis. There were some studies in the past, especially those European, that showed some benefit mm-hmm. To those in osteoarthritis. Now, it wasn't an amazing benefit, but it was enough to be significant, which gets into some research-type terms, because
right,
I think
exactly.
With numbers, you can make almost anything be significant in some instances. But mm-hmm. it did show some mild significance in terms of people's pain and symptoms. There's been others that have not shown that. So what I tell people with those medications is that, I think that there's, a possibility that it will help. It may not help. And so it's always worth a try. from that standpoint. And I know that that doesn't sound the most specific, but, you know, in arthritis, not everybody responds to the same types of supplements. I can't speak to how – it sounds like it works great for the dog, but I can't speak for how well that works in terms of, you know, veterinary arthritis from that standpoint. But if it works, it works.
Dr. Lindsley.
Yeah, there's no evidence that chondroitin or any of the other supplements make any difference or are at all helpful in childhood arthritis. And in a more general term, there are no supplements that have been shown to be helpful. Right?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation on arthritis. We'll talk about what it's like to live with chronic pain and then how to overcome it. We're going to be continuing our conversation with Dr. Mike Smith and Dr. Carol Lindsley after this break. If you'd like to call in during the break, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. What treatments have you used for arthritis? What's worked? And what are you hoping for from the future? Your stories and other treatment options when Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. If you're joining us, we're continuing our conversation with Dr. Mike Smith. He's a practicing rheumatologist here in Kansas City. And Dr. Carol Lindsley, she's a pediatric rheumatologist at the University of Kansas Hospital. We're exploring the disease of arthritis, something that will impact almost every single one of us at some point in our lifetime. And just want to start off here with an email from Jill. She asks, is there a link between arthritis and food poisoning? Is that a possibility, or is that something that's totally off the chart?
You know, if there's an infectious possibility, you know, there's like I said, there's over 100 different types of arthritis, and so you know you can get very specific. But if there's an infectious type process, sometimes people can develop what's called a reactive arthritis, mm-hmm. which fits into a type of inflammatory arthritis. I'm not thinking of anything specifically related to food poisoning, but from the infectious side of it, absolutely people can develop that after an infectious illness from food poisoning.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into the real issue of living with chronic chronic pain, and you know it also impacts your quality of life. When your patients come in to you, where are they typically on the pain scale when they come in with either osteo or rheumatoid arthritis and with juvenile arthritis? Dr. Smith, let's start with you.
You know, in terms of rheumatoid arthritis, it also varies per person. So I think mm-hmm. that the pain scale is obviously a very subjective
score.
But, you know, it varies per person. But on average, I would say that with, you know, new onset rheumatoid arthritis, you know, when it's in its full glory in many cases, you know, they're at the high end of the pain scale. With osteoarthritis, oftentimes they're more in the middle of the pain scale. It's more of a chronic, achy process. And I think that sometimes rheumatoid arthritis hits and it is so aggressive and can cause such a high degree of pain in a short period of time that the pain scores go up much more significantly, whereas osteoarthritis is more of a prolonged progression of that.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Lindsley, when the children come in?
Well, children may not complain of pain even though they have a lot of inflammation and a lot of active arthritis. So they may just not stop moving. They may complain of stiffness. And the older children certainly may voice pain concerns then. So we use a lot of different tools to try and assess their level of pain, a scale of faces, if you will. You know, smiley face mm-hmm. is no pain and frown is lots of pain. So we monitor that. But I would say with the treatments that have been developed over the last decade, the amount of pain that children have to deal with is a whole lot less, and our goal is to get rid of all of the of all of the consistent pain. Mm-hmm. All right,
is it hard for the children to kind of understand at times, you know, like why they're in so much pain, or like do they have feelings of like, you know, from a psychological perspective, do they deal with a lot of like depression or anxiety related to that
certainly,
chronic pain?
Particularly in older children and teenagers, can certainly lead to a lot of anxiety and sometimes depression. Mm-hmm. It's not just the pain of arthritis, but pain of having or the hassle of having any chronic disease can mm-hmm. lead to that in adolescence.
Mm-hmm. And are there things that you help counsel your patients on to try to, you know, get not just treat the pain, but also kind of treat that kind of like, I'm stuck with this kind of feeling?
Right. Well, first, my goal is to control the disease, and I feel if that can be done then the likelihood of them having severe pain in an ongoing fashion is very slim. Mm-hmm. But there are, as was mentioned, some of this is very subjective. So I do send some of my patients to counseling to help with handling the pain.
Mm-hmm. And how much can juvenile arthritis impact the quality of life with these individuals? Does it range?
Oh, yeah. It's a huge range. And when I started practicing a number of years ago, there were a lot of children that were totally disabled from the pain and the arthritis. And now that's very rare for that to have any sort of effect like that. It certainly can cause discomfort and certainly can limit their activities, but not the type of disablement that we used to see.
Dr. Smith, quality of life changes. You know, when you typically see patients, where's their quality of life scale, or does it range?
You know, early on, obviously, it's impacted because people are very limited in what they can and can't do. You know, if you can't get up and move very well, or you're very stiff, or, you know, you can't go and open up the top off of a bottle or open up, you know, a gallon of milk just because you can't even squeeze your hands well enough to do that. That's obviously very impactful, especially in rheumatoid arthritis. You know, with osteoarthritis, you know, there is going to be some expectation that that's not necessarily going to go away, but can be, you know, made better and at least symptomatically improved to the point where people can do some of those things and work with it over time. But, you know, like Dr. Lindsley was saying, the main goal is to treat the underlying causes if you can. And obviously with inflammatory arthritis, we often can. With osteoarthritis and some of these non-inflammatory causes, there's not as much of a targeting the underlying cause as there is a symptomatic treatment.
I'm going to be honest. It's kind of terrifying, like the idea like, well, you're a human, so you're probably going to get at least osteoarthritis. And, you know, there's a chance that you could get rheumatoid arthritis. And there's also a chance that any children you have could also get arthritis. What do we do? How do we treat this disease? And I understand that there have been a lot of advancements, particularly with rheumatoid arthritis. Is that correct, Dr. Smith?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously I wasn't practicing at the time that many of this was going on. But if you look on the internet, you see some very terrifying pictures of rheumatoid arthritis, the deforming changes and all these other things. You know, in my opinion, with the advances that happen today, and I don't think that I'm alone in that opinion, that those things shouldn't exist anymore. Also, a lot of the other manifestations, the other things that can happen with rheumatoid arthritis, the out the body, generally shouldn't really exist anymore, except in a very atypical and small percentage of patients. Mm-hmm. We've, you know, and I say we as in the rheumatology community and in science, have made amazing advances in terms of treatment. You know, in the mid to late 80s, methotrexate became very in vogue for use in rheumatoid arthritis, and that has made a world of difference. Other medications have also been shown with you know, immunosuppressives, more aggressive immunosuppressives with blocking certain molecules. You can see those on TV, the Enbrels, the Humiras, but there's others beyond that. There's multiple other types of classes of immunosuppressants that have also helped. And I think Dr. Lindsley can probably speak about that with kids as well. But there have been a number of advances in terms of treatment of that where those deforming changes shouldn't exist. And what I tell patients when I diagnose them for the first time is, don't expect that to happen. I have no intention of letting that happen if it's at all preventable. Mm-hmm. There is going to be that rare person that no matter what we do, that it could possibly happen. But in general, I don't think that should or does exist anymore, you know, provided that you're using the medications that are out there available for rheumatoid arthritis.
So a lot of medications that help particularly with rheumatoid arthritis and may actually, if not a cure, at least treat the disease.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The scary things that you can see on the internet and read about on the internet, I don't think exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's because of the medications we have and the advancements that we've had, and that there's not any lack of motivation to continue to come up with newer medications, because they continue to do so every couple of years, that there's a new class of medication that seems to work well. And so that there's a lot of different things. If one doesn't work, we move to the next one and keep going from there. But, you know, because there's lots of different people's genetics are all different, so they respond to different medications differently. But, you know, at some point we do find them that work, and most of the time it's the first one. But, you know, we can get people treated very well and get them to a very normal lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll come back to that in just a second. I want to come to Ken. Ken's calling from the Plaza. Ken, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks.
Good morning. And you have a question for us this morning?
Right. You guys mentioned the connection between smoking and arthritis. I was curious whether there has been any connection between alcohol use and arthritis.
Thank you, Ken. Dr. Smith?
You know, off the top of my head, I can't think that that's been shown specifically. I would say that many of the medications we use for rheumatoid arthritis prohibit you from drinking alcohol, just because their effects on the liver, both the medications and the added effect with alcohol. So in general, most patients with rheumatoid arthritis are somewhat prohibitive from drinking due to the medications that they're on.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Lindsley, I want to kind of shift it to you. Mentioned a number of medications that are available for rheumatoid arthritis. What kind of medication options do people with juvenile arthritis have?
We use many of the same medications that they use in adults, not all of them. Mm-hmm. Generally, the trials, studies of the drugs are done first in adults, and then if appropriate, we do them in children. But we still have a lot of drugs that are effective, and I agree that with his expectations that I expect my patients to have normal activity, go to school, and have a normal life. So that's the goal in controlling it, and usually with some combination of medication, we can do that. One that he mentioned called methotrexate has been a dramatic drug in children as well, and made all the difference between crippling disease and basically normal function. And then we add to that the family of drugs called anti-TNF drugs. One of those sometimes are added on, and there are others too. But that type of approach has been very successful. I would say beyond the drugs, the two things for children that impact their outcome is how early they're diagnosed and started on appropriate therapy, and how well they stick to the assigned regimen, and that's hard. No one likes to take medicine every day, day in and day out, and so that's a factor as to what the outcome is as well.
Do most of your patients with juvenile arthritis have to end up taking medication their entire life?
No, but maybe somewhere between 25 and 50% well. So there are a lot of them that may go into remission, but you still have to take regular medication, generally for months, if not years, to get everything to quiet down and to go into remission.
Essentially, you're trying to retrain the immune system to stop fighting its own joints.
That's the abnormal reaction. Mm. That's right.
We have a call here from Susan in Liberty. Susan, welcome to Central Standard.
Hello.
Morning. And what's your question for us?
Well, I have a comment that you had asked for things that were effective for some of us. Mm-hmm. I have had osteoarthritis, as has my husband. We're both in our late 60s. And for years, I haven't been able to take NSAIDs. So I went to something called MSM. I can give you a technical name if you care. And it has kept mine under control for years. My husband, about 2 weeks ago, he's a retired physician, and he was advised that he should stop taking NSAIDs for his arthritis because he's experiencing some kidney problems. And so for the next couple of days after he went off his NSAIDs, he was miserable. So I suggested perhaps he should try my MSM, and somewhat reluctantly, because it is an over-the-counter thing, he tried it. And he stopped being a grumpy old man and just became normal within about 3 days. And this has held for 2 weeks and running. So I just wanted to report that.
Interesting. Thank you, Susan, so much. So over-the-counter remedies, particularly for osteoarthritis, they can be enough?
You know, it varies per person. And what I always tell people, I think that sometimes that they're always nervous about telling their doctor, I take this over-the-counter or this supplement or that supplement. If it works, and as long as it's not hurting you, I'm generally okay with it. You know, as long as it doesn't interact with any other medications or cause you other problems, I think that that's great. You know, there are – some of this is a little bit of trial and error and what works best for every person. And, you know, not everyone responds. Even an example of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, the NSAIDs that she was talking about.
Like aspirin.
Yeah, or Tylenol – or not – sorry, not Tylenol, but ibuprofen or naproxen. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Some people will respond very well to ibuprofen and not to naproxen, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. And, you know – so like I said, some of this is trial and error, finding the best medications for each person. And so if there's a supplement out there that's causing you less problems, especially if you have a history of kidney disease or stomach problems or any and all those things, I'm on board with it.
Mm-hmm. We have just a few minutes left, but I definitely want to hit some of the other treatments that I've heard of. Diet, how big of a role does diet play in terms of helping to get you through these bouts of arthritis? Dr. Lindsley?
In children, there's I often get asked this question, but there has never been shown to be any sort of dietary deficiency that caused arthritis or was a problem there. So I just recommend regular diet. Children do need, because of their growing, they need adequate calcium, they need adequate iron and adequate calories. But there's no special supplement, no special diet that will make a difference in this type of arthritis.
The autoimmune nature of rheumatoid arthritis and some elements of juvenile arthritis, do those also tend to have a positive correlation with other autoimmune kind of family diagnoses like allergies, food allergies, and that kind of thing, or they tend to be unrelated? Dr. Lindsley?
The incidence of allergies in children is quite high. It's up to 20% of the population. So there obviously would be some overlap. But the only autoimmune disease that I see a lot in children that have arthritis is thyroid disease. And probably up to 15, maybe 20% of children will develop some sort of autoimmune thyroid disease as well.
And, you know, from a kind of from the beginning, from the diet standpoint, like Dr. Lindsley was saying, there's not any specific diet. What I tell people is just to be healthy. You know, the best thing to do is just follow a healthy diet, you know, and I think common sense type diet, obviously. But there's not anything in particular that's going to flare or improve the flare of arthritis in terms of what you're taking in with your diet from a diet standpoint. You know, from an autoimmune standpoint or from an immune system-related arthritis, you know, in regards to rheumatoid arthritis, probably the most common one that goes along with that is something called Sjogren's, which is an autoimmune process causing dry eyes and dry mouth, you know, and some other effects, some other manifestations as well. But that's probably the most common one with rheumatoid arthritis, but not anything necessarily other than that.
Always short on time. We have about 30 seconds left. The role of exercise, Dr. Lindsley, in about 15 seconds. What kind of exercise?
It's very important for growing children. Particularly, I encourage them to find a couple of exercises, activities that they like, and to do it, particularly swimming, karate. Those are particularly helpful, but most of the kids can take any type of exercise activity they want.
Low impact, the swimming.
Right.
And I would agree with that. You know, water exercises are great, but keeping your joints moving is extremely important for both rheumatoid and osteoarthritis.
Well, thank you both so much for coming. We'll have to have this conversation again. It's all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank Dr. Mike Smith. He's a rheumatologist here in Kansas City, and also Dr. Carol Lindsley. She's a pediatric rheumatologist at the University of Kansas Hospital. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows at KCUR.org/Central Standard. Tune in tomorrow as we sleep and dream. We'll be exploring the relationship between sleep, dreams, memory, and emotion. Our show is produced by Christy Garten and myself with Kate Baxendale. Our announcer is Linda Scher. Stay tuned for Up to Date. They're going to be having a conversation with a surgeon who's coming to terms with his own mortality. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and this is KCUR.